It's time for Security Now. I'm back. Steve Gibson's here. And we have a lot to talk about, including a little more information about how Apple's Face ID works. A judge who says, no, the FBI doesn't have to tell you anything about how it unlocked that iPhone. And Moxie Marlin spike in another discovery, this time signals the victim, plus the secret life of bees. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 631, recorded Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. Private Contact Discovery. Security Now is brought to you by Tongue. Did you know 90% of bad breath comes from your tongue? The world's most effective tongue cleaning system, Tongue Brush and Gel, takes only 10 seconds. Discover confidence and freshness like never before. For 10% off the partner pack and free shipping, visit tonguebrush.com/securitynow and use the offer code SECURITYNOW. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million people. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team's skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest news from the security front. It is a front. It's a war out there. Thank goodness. General Gibson is here, Commander-in-Chief.
Welcome back from your two-week cruise around the world, wherever it was you went.
I just went up the river, that's all.
Up the river, okay.
Up the river, but
well,
it was a
fortunately,
nice vacation.
You came back down the river, yeah, so.
Thanks to Father Robert, who everybody agrees should be hosting this show from now on. It's okay. It's okay. It doesn't hurt my feelings much, but I am.
Well,
glad
you
to be
did
here.
Announce you were gonna. You are loving your vacations and your travel. So
I'm not giving up this show. We've been doing this 13 years.
Yes, we are in our 13th year.
Unbelievable. And good news is no security problems at all this week.
Yeah.
Did you see? There's one that just broke that is hysterical and has nothing to say about it. But Yahoo now admits that every account was hacked. 3 billion, with a B, accounts were hacked in that 2013 exfiltration.
And I liked your comment on MacBreak Weekly that would be the largest ever. And one reason is that there used to be much more concentration into a single provider. And now we have a much more heterogeneous environment where not everybody is at Yahoo the way they used to be.
Right,
so
right, right.
I think it is the case that no one outfit will be able to be as devastating. So episode 631 today, as I was pulling things together, one interesting bit stood out that acquired the title, which is the reason this is called Private Contact Discovery. Our friend Moxie Marlin Spike and his gang working on Signal have tackled the problem of concealing contact metadata, which is an unsolved problem, really, until now. We've talked, for example, about how even when, for example, email content is encrypted, the fact of the mail moving from person A to person B cannot really be hidden. And so it's often the case that who you're talking to is as much a useful piece of information, and unfortunately, a breach of privacy, as what it is you say. And in the world of instant messaging, which Moxie's Signal protocol addresses, and we've talked about Signal's ratchet mechanism and how, what a perfect job they have done. So much so that other platforms have adopted the OpenSignal protocol for themselves because it's so good. One of the remaining problems has been how does a new person join the Signal ecosystem or the Signal universe and discover who in their contacts are other Signal users without the central repository that glues all this together, knowing that they've done so, like knowing what contacts they have in common. Anyway, they figured out how to do this. So that's we'll wrap up the podcast talking about that. But of course, we do have our week's worth of news. We're going to talk about – I have to talk a little bit about my experiences with iOS version 11. Won't take up much time, but I just want to kind of go on record with what I have found. Also, for a couple of weeks, there have been a number of stories about various instances of browser hijack cryptocurrency mining. And so I want to talk sort of generically about the emergence of this as a thing and what it means. We have some additional information about the Equifax hack, some amazing coverage thanks to Bloomberg. Google's security research is uncovering new problems. So they have also anonymously, some people at Google have announced some plans for improvements in Gmail security as a consequence, essentially, of this emerging awareness of how much Russia was involved in this past presidential election. There were some specious rumors, well, actually stories, about breaking DKIM, which is the email authentication protocol that we've actually been talking about not too long ago. Turns out it wasn't broken, but we'll explain what happened. Also, there's some new concerns over many small servers in routers, which are exploitable. And you also were talking on MacBreak about motherboard EFI firmware concerns, mostly focused on Apple, as you said, because the researchers were able to more easily explore various Apple Mac systems and the firmware that they had. But this, we're going to broaden it, of course, for this podcast and talk about also the impact on Windows and Linux-based hardware. There's a privacy leakage bug in IE. We'll do some miscellany. We got a bunch of interesting, and I think pretty quick, closing the loop feedback from our listeners. And then we're going to take a close look at this beautiful work that Moxie and his group at Signal have done in order to protect the discovery of other people in your existing contacts who you want to converse with over Signal without disclosing the fact that you have found them, which turns out to be a much harder problem than one would expect. Hmm. So I think a great podcast.
Yes. Did you know? This is the weirdest. Okay. I got to tell you, though, this guy is a fan of the show. And he said, look, I think Steve will like this. We're going to say, I thought we were going to send you some, but I guess you haven't got it yet. Maybe we want to.
My tongue has not been scraped.
It's not scraping. It's better than scraping. I think that we wanted to surprise you. At least I did with the tongue brush. And I've been using it now for a couple of months, believe it or not. And I love it. A lot of the bad breath comes from sticky bacteria that hide out. I'll show you the graphic in the nooks and crannies of your tongue. And let's not be too graphic, but they give off that kind of sulfury smell that we recognize as bad breath. It's also a health issue, and we're learning this more and more. And I know you know this, that the mouth turns out to be kind of a cesspool. And sometimes dentists will make you take antibiotics before they do dental work because of the bacteria. Major contribution to not only periodontal disease, gum disease, but it's linked to heart disease, to diabetes, to colon cancer. The problem is all of this stuff lurks in the back of your tongue. And if you're trying to use a toothbrush to do it, it's just the wrong shape. You're going to gag. So I'll introduce you to the tongue brush. It is a round brush with short, firm bristles designed to penetrate the tongue's hard-to-reach crevices and remove those sticky, odor-causing bacteria. You don't gag because it's round. It's not, you're not poking something down your back of your throat. And it allows you to cover a lot of the surface area all at once. You only need to do it for a few seconds. And I've been doing it. By the way, it also comes with the tongue gel, which is a formula that includes zinc, which helps also to neutralize odor-causing gases. It tastes minty fresh, and I will vouch for it. It keeps your breath stays fresh a whole lot longer. With tongue, you won't wonder about your breath anymore. Tonguebrush.com/securitynow. If you use the offer code securitynow, you'll get 10% off the partner pack, a tongue brush and a 3-ounce tongue gel. Just try it for you and your significant other. 2 brushes and 2 tubes of gel plus free shipping. Because it doesn't make, if you're kissing, if you're making out, it doesn't do any good if only one of you uses the tongue. You know what I'm saying? You both need to use your tongue brush. Tongue brush, T-U-N-G, not T-O-U-N-G, TUNGbrush.com/securitynow, and use the offer code securitynow for 10% off the partner pack and the free shipping. And I got to say, I use it. We're going to send it to you now that the surprise is worn off. We'll send you one. You can just tell me, however you feel. See if you like it. I've been using it. Lisa insists now.
I have a wonderful woman to test it on.
Oh, so I'm glad to hear that. We'll send you 2 then. Tongue brush, TUNGbrush.com/security. Now, I knew that I just wanted to sneak this one up on you. And they're such fans of the show. I thought, okay, good. This is beyond.
Well, and I love
now.
The name. You couldn't
Isn't
get
it?
A better name.
Yeah.
T-U-N-G.
Tongue.
Tonguebrush.com.
Use more tongue with your tongue brush.
Oh, good.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
So, our picture of the week just cracked me up. It caught me by surprise. Someone tweeted it to me, and it's apropos of the data disclosures that we've been having lately. It shows some bees flying around in a hive, and the caption says, "Security failure. EpiPen's database of everyone who's allergic to bees has been obtained by bees."
That's good. That's good.
I just thought it's
Oh,
perfect.
You're in trouble now, boy. The bees know who you are.
The bees know who you are. They know how to selectively sting because they only get one shot at that, I think. So
that is funny.
I thought that was great. Yeah.
Wow.
So just briefly on iOS 11, I don't know yet how 11.0.1 compares, but right out of the gate, it was the buggiest release of iOS I have ever experienced.
What problems did you experience?
Oh my God! Everything I tried, every one of my devices, I have 7 pads and my phone, and they were all doing bizarre things.
Oh,
like
dear.
I remember in iMessage, one of the balloons got stuck, so that when I changed to a different message channel, the other ones were scrolling underneath.
I've seen weird cosmetic things like that. Yeah.
Yes, and the dock got stuck on the vertical side, and as I rotated, everything else rotated around, but the dock just stood where it stuck where it was, and on one of my pads, whenever the preview when the screen is locked, where you're able to see things,
yeah.
Every time I touch it to scroll it, it flashes white really briefly and then kind of settles down. I mean, if Jobs were still around, heads would be rolling, or they wouldn't have shipped it. I don't know, but I love iOS. I use it as much as I use Windows, and it was just – it just completely collapsed.
And so what did you do? Did you roll back?
No, I just kind of shook the pads more and turned – I often turn them off and back on, and then it's okay for a while. I mean, it's really – and I'm hoping that 11.0.1 that came out, late last week, I'm hoping that it's going to be an improvement. And I think it'll take – a few times. I mean, it's a big change. I've heard you loving the control center, as I do too. Now that I've kind of got the hang of switching and going to the control center and all that. So, you know, there's some learning stuff. But the other problem I have, and this is not something they can fix, is it's really slower on older hardware. And so, you know, I mean, this is sort of a natural thing that's happening, is they're wanting to do more aggressive, deeper features that are inherently synchronized with the ever more powerful chips that they're releasing in their newer hardware. The problem is they're updating older hardware with the newer software. And for a while, I was misunderstanding its lack of response as it wasn't getting my screen clicks. And there is no feedback. You know, it's not like it goes click when you tap the screen. The assumption is its response will be immediate. So you get visual confirmation that you press the right thing. And so what I've learned on my older pads is that are all now, I mean, I moved to iOS 11 on everything, is you tap and you just kind of be patient. You wait for a while and then it goes blink and does whatever you asked it to. But I mean, it's a noticeable delay. It's beautiful on the latest hardware, but boy, you can really feel it on the older hardware. So, you know, I don't think there's a solution for that. Apple continues to want to be on the absolute bleeding edge with their hardware. They're wanting to leverage the newer hardware, but they're also not wanting, for example, to continue to support iOS 9 or 10 in perpetuity. And I understand that, but boy, the older hardware just doesn't have the horsepower to keep up with what the latest hardware is doing. You really do need the newer hardware. And of course, Apple wants you to buy that. So, because they're in the hardware selling business, as we know. So anyway, just my few cents worth on iOS 11. I love what they've done, but you know, and I can see myself maybe moving to a newer phone, not because there's anything wrong with my 6S, whatever it is, or 6 Plus.
Just the speed. Yeah.
It's just getting older. Yeah.
I mean, you look at the benchmarks for the new processor, the A11.
The 11, yes.
And it's through the roof. It's almost MacBook Pro speed. There's no real need for that. But yeah, you have to figure that once they've got it, people will find ways to use it. And we've seen that, remember, with Windows, and we've seen that for years, you know.
Yes. And I actually think that's one of the things that happened where we were having the audio problems was that we thought that maybe the old USB interface I was using was getting just a little glitchy. It was 12 years old. I hadn't changed it through the entire life of the podcast. So we switched to a newer, more aggressive interface, and that older machine didn't have the horsepower to drive it.
That makes sense.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's the way of the world, alas.
Yeah, it is. And you know me, I stick with what I've got until I'm finally driven off of it. And
I'm
now feeling like, well, okay. And I'm sure that the iPhone 10 is going to be gorgeous, and I will have skipped the 6S and the 7 and the 8.
Oh,
and
probably you're going to see a big difference. Oh my gosh, yeah. You're on a 6.
Yeah,
oh
and
my.
I'm waiting.
Oh
I,
my!
I click and I touch and wait.
Oh my! But yeah,
yeah. So Apple published an interesting security guide for Face ID that didn't have a ton of new information in it, but it was interesting. We know that it employs what they call their true depth camera system, but one of the things that I appreciated that I want to share with our listeners because I read the whole thing carefully, is that it demonstrates a truly gratifying focus, if you'll pardon the pun, on security, where things they did demonstrated that, I mean, it was above and beyond. For example, we know that they project an infrared dot grid onto the user's face that an IR camera sees. And they use that essentially in order to put little spots all over the person, you know, like chicken pox spots, in order to use that as part of their recognition. Well, for example, the sequence in which the dots are drawn is device specific on purpose. So that because what they're doing is they're actually scanning with a dot sequence, and so that the camera picks up where each dot is in three space, and the sequence is device specific, so that you cannot capture the data from one device and then somehow arrange to play it into another device in order to spoof it. It won't get fooled because the sequence will be wrong. So they use a per device pseudo random sequence. And I mean, and just that demonstrates, okay, somebody really spent some time to think about how to make this as robust against hacking as possible. So, and other information just to sort of assure people is that it is explicitly local authentication, meaning that the facial recognition stuff never leaves that device. It has this crazy, as we were just talking, this A11 processor with a hardware assist neural network, what they call their neural engine. And so what do they call it? A bioneural chip or something? The reason the bio-ness is in there is that thanks to the fact that it uses a neural network as part of the processing of this image data. But for example, it's been controversial that devices like Amazon's Echo, after you do the, you know, hello word in order to activate it, then it streams your voice to the cloud for recognition. And so the point is that the phone has so much horsepower, so much processing power, the iPhone X, that it's all done locally. So none of your facial images, none of that the camera sees during this process ever leaves the camera. It stays there, and all the processing is done locally. And then the other thing that they have done, and the way they described it, I wanted to quote this because, again, it demonstrates a real thoughtful set of trade-offs. They said, to use Face ID, you must set up iPhone X so that a passcode is required to unlock it. When Face ID detects and matches your face, iPhone X unlocks without asking for the device passcode. Face ID makes using a longer, more complex passcode far more practical because you don't need to enter it as frequently. Face ID doesn't replace your passcode, but provides easy access to iPhone X within thoughtful boundaries and time constraints. This is important, they write, because a strong passcode forms the foundation of your iOS device's cryptographic protection. And what that put me in mind of was that I had made exactly the same set of trade-offs in the Squirrel client. That is, we have you are encouraged to create a strong passphrase to authenticate yourself to Squirrel. But once you've done so, you are then within certain conditions allowed to use a much shorter. In fact, you just use the first N characters of your much stronger passcode to re-authenticate yourself once you have first authenticated yourself. And Apple's has done exactly the same thing. For example, we know we're all familiar with how they handle Touch ID, and how you must, if you haven't used a Touch ID-based device for 2 days, you must then re-enter your full passphrase. Well, that has a couple consequences. One is it's good for security. It also keeps you from permanently forgetting what your longer passphrase is, if you're not constantly using your device. So they've done the same sort of thing with even on a device which is Face ID unlocked. It's still so the passcode is still required in a set of different circumstances after it's just been turned on or restarted. Again, if it hasn't been used for 2 days, for 48 hours, if the passcode hasn't been used to unlock the device in the last 6.5 days, so just shy of 1 week, for some reason they chose 156 hours, and Face ID has not unlocked the device in the last 4 hours. So again, a set of interesting sort of heuristics that they settled on in order to create a sort of a flexible security boundary based on how active you are, but also to continue refreshing your use of your face and your weekly use of your original passcode, so that, because that's the ultimate unlock. And then they have, you know, more accessible, shorter term unlocks as long as you do it often enough. And you know, and I get that, because it's the same sort of thing that I have just recently done in order to come to reach a compromise, but between having a passcode which is strong enough to be resistant against cracking, yet offers a trade-off, much as Face ID does, to still allow you to use your device frequently and conveniently every time you pick it up. And you know, as for this whole one in a million that they're now claiming for facial recognition versus one in 50,000 for Touch ID, it's like, well, I think we'll have to see how that goes. I'm sure people will be experimenting with trying to hack it. And you know, much as we saw with Touch ID, where they were immediately using, you know, gummy bears and things in order to lift prints and create fake thumbs and so forth. So I think we'll have to sort of see how this plays out. But boy, I couldn't be happier with the clear attention that Apple has paid to getting this right out of the gate. And of course, you know, we haven't seen it yet. It'll be sometime before we do, I guess. But anyway, very, very impressed. And that grid is 30,000 infrared dots, which are used not just, you know, 30,000 in order to form what they call a depth map, in order to differentiate your actual physical face from a 2D infrared image. And they also do pupil tracking dynamically to determine that you are looking at the camera. So you can't be looking away or have your eyes closed and have this function. So that's how the kids are prevented from holding, you know, mommy's camera up in front of her while she's sleeping and unlocking the phone. Nope. Mom's eyes have to be open and they have to be pointed at the phone. So pupil recognition is used in order to verify that your eyes are focused on the device itself. So again, I think they did everything that they reasonably could. We'll have to just see over time how this evolves into a, you know, the actual user experience. So in the last couple of weeks, there has been a number of articles about malicious, unquote, ads doing cryptocurrency mining on users' browsers unwittingly, that is unknown to the user, when they were visiting a site. And then most recently, several Showtime domains were found to be also covertly mining cryptocurrency. This wasn't Showtime trying to augment their revenues. This was some bad guys got into the Showtime server and added crypto mining technology to what was produced when a user went to the Showtime properties and downloaded a Showtime page. So I just sort of wanted to address this, the whole idea of this, a little more broadly. First of all, what we remember from our initial discussion of Bitcoin mining is that a variable, we could call it variable hardness, but it's really a variable probability problem is being solved by a cryptocurrency miner. That is, the idea is a random number is being chosen, and over time, the probability of guessing correctly is decreased, making it harder and harder to guess the magic number. And thus, miners that have gone from just CPUs to GPUs to FPGAs to, you know, custom hardware, they've gotten faster at guessing. The idea being that the probability of guessing correctly is vanishingly small now. So the more times you're able to guess per second, the greater the chance that this diminishing percentage of chance will be correct. And if you guess correctly, you win a coin or a fraction of a coin. And that's changing over time, too. Everybody remembers how when I first did the podcast on Bitcoin, I started up a miner. In fact, it was on that machine, Leo, that the machine that's now too slow even to run, you know, audio for Skype sufficiently well, that I woke up the next morning and there was 50 Bitcoins sitting there. I was like, oh.
But that was kind of luck, right? It wasn't that it was working so hard.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. I didn't expect
it's like
it.
A jackpot.
And it's luck for everybody. And I'm glad you said that because that's exactly what's happening here. So the idea is that bad guys are putting cryptocurrency mining JavaScript into users' browsers, into ads, or stuffing them onto websites that are hackable, like apparently Showtime's was. And they're getting all the visitors of Showtime or all the people who display this hijacked ad to do a little crypto mining for them. And the chances are, I mean, first of all, a browser is a bad miner. It's like so far down the curve, you can't even find it. You don't want to be doing, you know, cryptocurrency mining in your browser.
No, you want custom ASICs and massive GPUs.
Precisely.
SLI and, yeah.
But it costs them nothing to.
Well, that's the other way to do it. Go massively parallel, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so here's the other problem. And I realized as I was putting this together that I haven't checked in with Mark Thompson, who's my good friend and fellow massive miner, because as we know, there's been a huge growth in the value, for example, of Bitcoin recently. And last time we talked, as I have said on this podcast, you could not mine in California because our power costs more than the electricity required to earn or/mine bitcoins. But in Phoenix, for whatever reason, power is cheap. And so it made sense for him to be mining in Arizona, but you can't do it in California, but you can do it under Niagara Falls, where, again, power is very inexpensive. So I don't know how that has changed as Bitcoin, for example, has gone crazy in value to the point now where those 50 bitcoins, I really do have to find them because they're now approaching $250,000 worth of value. Of course, yeah, it is. Believe it or not,
whoa,
it's like $4,300 now for a Bitcoin.
But you don't want to be the guy who had 50 Bitcoins and traded in for $250,000 when in 5 years it's worth $100 million.
That's the problem too.
But it's like any stock; you got to know when to sell it.
But I'm also a Boy Scout. How's that go? Is that the Boy Scout salute? So I will be reporting my Bitcoins to the IRS because I'm not going to screw around with that.
Mm-mm.
They're now getting very annoyed with people who are cashing in their Bitcoins and not reporting them as income.
Is it regular income? I guess it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like winning the lottery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it very much so. So, yes, I'm not in any hurry to do anything with them, but it would be nice to know
find
where
them.
They are.
I know. I have my wallet backed up somewhere, and I can't remember the password. I only have 5, though. If I had 50, I might make more of a concerted effort.
Yeah, it's a little more motivation.
Yeah.
So, anyway, what I wanted to say to people is that, you know, so what's annoying is that somebody is using your CPU. On the other hand, okay, you know,
So is every ad. So is every
exact.
Yeah.
Yes, and the autoplay videos, that those are pegging people's CPUs just as much as cryptocurrency mining is. So, you know, it's
how much time do you spend on the Showtime site anyway?
Precisely.
Yeah. Is it the watching a movie Showtime site or just the logging into Showtime site?
It was several different domains. So
wasn't
probably
Showtime
going,
anytime or.
Yeah, it's
see if it was.
It's when it's. Well, it's probably when you're looking at something in your browser and they're having a chance to run JavaScript.
Right. Huh.
So anyway, so it's, you know, it's an annoyance. I guess it's not surprising that. So I guess the point is that our browsers are hardened against JavaScript being able to hurt us, like as in, you know, malware. But they're not hardened against JavaScript being able to do work. And because, I mean, that's what it's for, is doing work. And so they're like, well, okay, maybe this user is at a website that's going to pay them if their browser scores a coin. No, but it could be. So anyway, that's what's going on with that. It's like, yeah, okay. So, yeah, it's using some of your power and some of your processor, but, you know, so are you when you're doing anything. So no biggie, really. We covered extensively over the years the San Bernardino terrorist attack where Syed Farouk had his two phones. And, of course, Apple famously refused to help the FBI to unlock this phone, which
I wonder if they would still have that attitude today. Seriously, what if the Vegas shooter had
an
iPhone?
Seriously, good point.
It would be politically very difficult for them to say no now.
Really, yes, yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the wake of this is that the AP, the Associated Press, USA Today, and Vice Media all sued under the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, in the U.S. for disclosure by the FBI of who it was they worked with and how much they paid, because those are taxpayer dollars. And the argument was, hey, you know, this is a taxpayer-funded operation. We want to know. Now, James Comey, as we'll remember, the former FBI director, did indirectly disclose that they paid something around $1.3 million for this hacking tool from an undisclosed company. So we really don't know who it was. We never got an exact amount. But these press companies, these press agencies wanted to know. On Saturday of last weekend, a U.S. district judge in the D.C., the District of Columbia in the U.S., Tanya Chutkan, disagreed with the suit that was brought by these companies and said no. The FBI has no obligation, even under FOIA, to make this disclosure. She said in her decision that, quote, it is logical and plausible that the vendor may be less than the vendor, meaning the one that that the FBI paid, that the vendor, the undisclosed vendor, may be less capable than the FBI of protecting its proprietary information in the face of a cyber attack. Therefore, an argument for allowing this vendor who received taxpayer money to remain anonymous. She also wrote the FBI's conclusion that releasing the name of the vendor to the general public could put the vendor's systems and therefore crucial information about the technology at risk of incursion is reasonable. So they might be subjected to an attack. And then regarding the cost of the hacking tool, Tanya agreed with the U.S. government that revealing the price the government paid for unlocking the iPhone could harm national security, okay, saying, quote, releasing the purchase price would designate a finite value for the technology and help adversaries determine whether the FBI can broadly utilize the technology to access their encrypted devices. Okay. So translation is the FBI asked to keep this information private and it got its way. So we're not going to find out who they got it from and what they paid. And that's sort of closed. And remember also that it's not at all clear that even then, if it weren't an iPhone 5C, that it would have been possible to make this happen. It what I remember from the time was that it was the fact that it was a 5C that fit together with maybe some known exploits against that particular make and model that allowed a third party to get in and to have a big payday for themselves, because this was, as you said, it was at the time very politically sensitive. And you raised a good question, I think, Leo, whether, you know, in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, if a similar thing happened, whether Apple would be able to say no. Or
be hard for them, right? Be hard.
Yeah.
Be difficult.
Yeah.
By the way, this is just in, and you'll love this. The IRS has just awarded a $7.25 million fraud prevention contract to Equifax. So that Equifax will let them know if any refund requests come from compromised Equifax information.
Boy, talk about making money coming and going.
But we knew they'd make money on this breach because they were pushing people towards for 1 year,
yep,
free, identity theft monitoring service. When, of course, you know, in another year, you'd be paying for it. It's just, God,
I know.
Scum. Scum.
Time for a break.
Yes. I'm sorry. That's one of the reasons I interrupted you. I thought it'd be a good time
good.
For you to get some coffee and me to talk about somebody lovely, FreshBooks.com. FreshBooks is our sponsor of this portion of Security Now. But they're more than that to me. I have a personal stake in FreshBooks since they saved my tuchus some years ago when I was a lowly TV host. Steve knows about this because he was up there with me in Toronto,
yep,
doing call for help. And I had to invoice Rogers every month for, you know, my expenses and everything. And I would just put it off and put it off and put it off. And I would then complain that I wasn't getting paid. I wasn't getting paid. I wasn't getting paid. Amber MacArthur told me, oh, there's this new startup. This is 2004 in Toronto called FreshBooks. It makes it really easy to do invoicing. So I tried them, and I was hooked. I love FreshBooks. It kind of is nice that it's come all the way around now that we're doing ads for FreshBooks. FreshBooks is more now than just simple invoicing. They have so many new features. Of course, it starts with the invoice. It makes it very easy for you to create invoices in any currency. And that was important to me because I had to convert to Canadian dollars. Take the expenses. Just take a picture of them with the FreshBooks app. They go right into the FreshBooks invoice that makes it very easy to see which invoices have been sent, which have been viewed, which have been paid. So no more can customers say, oh, I didn't get your invoice. You'll know. And you get paid, on average, 11 days faster. That's what their research shows. 11 days faster. Plus, there's all sorts of new features. I would have loved this. Reward prompt clients and encourage customer loyalty by adding discounts on recurring templates. So if they pay you fast, then you give them a deal. It's very easy to bill for time by client and by projects. They've got timers in the apps and on the website. You can assign services to projects, designate different rates for different services. It can be very complex, but FreshBooks can handle it. And then the beauty part of this is, because they've been keeping track of invoices, that is, accounts receivable, accounts paid, accounts outstanding, and expenses, they actually know how you're doing. They can tell you on the front page, the dashboard, the new FreshBooks dashboard, literally tells you, are you making money this year? Are you making money this week, this month? You know stuff you just wouldn't know. Really, I would never know how much I made or whether I made money until a tax time. Oh, and by the way, when tax time comes, your accountant, your bookkeeper, you, whoever does your taxes, will love it that you've been using FreshBooks. All the reports you need to do taxes fast and easy. All sorts of new features to get quick access to your spending, your outstanding balances, your total profit, and other accounting reports right there in the dashboard. Sticky headers allow you to scroll through any page, but you don't lose. You know how it is on a spreadsheet where you scroll and you don't know what the columns are because the headers go off the screen? No, they've got these great sticky headers that shrink and remain at the top so you know exactly what you're looking at. It's little things like that. They're just really, these guys know what they're doing, and they are always adding new features. See receipt attachments when you view invoices in the iOS app. Employees can log in on the FreshBooks mobile app for iOS, making it easy for them to take care of business. So, you know, your employees can help you get those books done. The full description of every line item is now visible while viewing an invoice on mobile. On and on and on. They have great FAQ articles with the new help widget. You just click on the blue question mark and you can figure out what's going on. But I don't think you're going to need to. One of the things I love about FreshBooks is it's doing accounting, but not because of you. You don't have to know. You just have to make invoices. Do the stuff you know, it's easy, and it does all the hard stuff behind the scenes. No wonder FreshBooks was included in the Forbes Small Giants list for 2017. If doing invoicing, if keeping track of your money, of your accounting, is driving you nuts, go to FreshBooks.com/security now, right now, and change your life. Just put security now in the How Did You Hear About Us section. You'll get 30 days free. That's enough time to decide if this is for you. I think you'll think it is. I know you will. Save my life. FreshBooks.com/security now. I thank you for saving me way back when. I have people who do that now. Thank God. Because I was... Lisa's great. She says, how did you survive? In fact, that's how I met... You know that's how I met Lisa? My CPA would go... You know, Dana and I would go to the CPA on April 1st every year, say... Here are the records. And the CPA finally said, you're going to go to jail. I have two people. I can give you their names. They can fix your books, not illegally, but they could clean them up so that I can do your taxes so you won't go to jail. And right. Name one was Lisa. I never got to name two. She came in and she transformed our business. Thank you, Lisa. Thank God I have her. But before Lisa, there was FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com/security now. Steve is now properly caffeinated.
I am again.
I'm going to have to one of our other new sponsor is Blue Bottle Coffee. I'm going to have to get them to send you some. Have you ever tried Blue Bottle?
No, never heard of them.
They're big up here in San Francisco. They're like huge. I'll get some coffee sent to you. You'll like it.
Ooh, yeah. Neat.
Along with the tongue brush.
Yes. I'm not sure what order I use it in. But,
I can tell you. Okay. Coffee first, brush second.
Nice. So I know that everyone is like fed up with hearing about Equifax.
Oy.
But while you were on vacation, Leo, I attended a private security conference.
I heard you say
where
that.
There was some inside scuttlebutt suggesting that this was looking more and more like a state-sponsored attack.
You thought it was China.
Yes, and that seems to be the consensus. That's beginning to surface. And the good news, then there's sort of mixed blessing, that it suggests that if it's a major actor, they really don't care.
It's not about credit card for them. Credit card
fraud.
Yeah.
They don't care about the 143 million of us. What they do care about are specific people who are high profile targets.
Yeah.
And Bloomberg had some fabulous coverage. I'm not going to go through the whole thing because it's long, but the link is in the show notes for anyone who wants more. But I want to give our listeners a sense for just four paragraphs from their coverage. They write, Nike Zheng, a Chinese cybersecurity researcher from – and this establishes sort of the history and the background, which wasn't clear before. From a bustling industrial center near Shanghai, probably knew little about Equifax, writes Bloomberg, or the value of the data pulsing through its servers. When he exposed a flaw in popular back-end software for web applications called Apache Struts, which, of course, we talked about weeks ago. That's the Java-based server-side platform for developing web applications that Equifax, among many other people, are using. They write, information he provided to Apache, which published it along with a fix on March 6th of this year, showed how the flaw could be used to steal data from any company using the software. The average American, Bloomberg writes, had no reason to notice Apache's post, but it caught the attention of the global hacking community. Within 24 hours, the information was posted to freebuff.com, a Chinese security website, and showed up the same day in Metasploit, which, as we know, is a popular free hacking tool. On March 10th, so 4 days after the disclosure, hackers scanned the internet for computer systems vulnerable to the attack and got a hit on an Equifax server in Atlanta, according to people familiar with the investigation. So 4 days after the disclosure, Apache did everything they could responsibly. They said, whoops, we have a problem. Here's the fix. And 4 days later, internet was scanned. Equifax was identified as a target. Before long, Bloomberg writes, hackers had penetrated Equifax. They may not have immediately grasped the value of their discovery, but as the attack escalated over the following months, that first group, get this, known as an entry crew, handed off to a more sophisticated team of hackers. They homed in on a bounty of staggering scale. The financial data, social security numbers, birth dates, addresses, and more of at least 143 million Americans. By the time they were done, and here's news, the attackers had accessed dozens of sensitive databases and created more than 30 separate entry points into Equifax's computer systems, meaning that this initial Apache Struts was just a means of gaining a foothold. And once they did, they established 30 other presences that would protect them in case of the discovery. So Bloomberg writes, the attackers were finally discovered on July 29th, but were so deeply embedded that the company was forced to take a consumer complaint portal offline for 11 days because it was so massively compromised, while the security team found and closed the back doors the intruders had set up. And then finally, the handoff to more sophisticated hackers is among the evidence that led some investigators inside Equifax to suspect a nation state was behind the hack. That is, you know, the people who discovered it weren't the people who continued exploiting. Rather, they found it, and then they said they basically passed it upstairs to a more sophisticated next level group who then got it, you know, crawled inside and began to exploit. They write, many of the tools used were Chinese. And these people say the Equifax breach has the hallmarks of similar intrusions in recent years at the giant health insurer Anthem, which, of course, is, remember, 18 months ago is the reason we first told everybody to lock down their credit ports at the time, and the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. Both were ultimately attributed to hackers working for Chinese intelligence. So, you know, this is the way these things are now being done. And this, I mean, it's not good that 143 million Americans and some Canadian and UK citizens had this detailed personal data exfiltrated from Equifax. But, you know, as you said, Leo, it suggests that we're not all in immediate threat. It's not as if some hacker was some money-oriented, financially-oriented hacker would be selling this, you know, in bulk in order to immediately turn it into profit. It seems much more likely that if this is, in fact, China, they, among this 143 million, are a lot of, to them, very valuable information, which they could then use for targeting specific individuals. So not good for those targeted people, but yeah, somewhat better for the rest of us, we can hope. We've talked over the course of the last month or two about the Broadcom firmware problem that essentially beset all of our mobile devices. Both Android and iOS devices were vulnerable. Google and their Pixel devices were first to patch and patched very quickly. I'm not sure. I don't remember now where Samsung was on this, but we covered a series of patches that iOS released and finished with 10.3.3 was the most recent before jumping to 11.0.1. This comes back to our attention because a Google researcher has published a proof of concept exploit that is functional against Apple iPhone Wi-Fi Broadcom chips prior to iOS version 10.3.3. So the good news is you don't have to update to 11 to be protected against this.
Is that because Apple discovered it and fixed it, or just in the process of updating it fixed some issue?
No, they did discover it, or it was reported and fixed.
Got it.
So they did it in 10.3.3. Remember, we had 10.3.2, and we thought, and there was some Broadcom fix there, and we presumed that that was this big one, but it turns out no, it wasn't until 10.3.3, which was the final version 10 iOS before jumping to 11. So for people who, for whatever reason, are holding off on moving to 11, and despite all my complaints, like you, Leo, I really like 11. I'm liking the things that they did, although, as I said, it comes at a cost of performance on older hardware. But somebody who wants to stay at 10, as long as you're current, which puts you at 10.3.3, then this is fixed. But the significant thing is that now with a public proof of concept, that means anybody who wants to attack a pre-10.3.3 iOS device has a template for doing so. And it is a potent attack. Remember that you don't need to be associated with the Wi-Fi device. Your phone just has to be within range, that is radio range. Your phone and the attacker's radio need to be able to reach each other and and you don't, so you don't have to log in or use a malicious access point. It just, you just have to be able to be enumerated essentially by the Broadcom chip, and that's enough for your phone to be taken over. So I imagine, I mean, the good news is Apple pushes these updates out. And so, you know, they're really good about keeping their phone's OS current and patching the firmware in the related devices like this Broadcom chip. But this is something everybody wants to do because it does make the attacks much more likely now. And I heard you talking on MacBreak Weekly, Leo, about just in general about this evolving awareness of how much Russia had their tentacles into the most recent U.S. presidential election. We've seen news in the press about Facebook, you know, taking real steps to understand how much Russia was purchasing ads on Facebook. Twitter has done the same thing, recognizing the extent to which they were unwitting accomplices in Russian involvement. And now Google has said, although it's not official yet, and the Google personnel who have been talking to the press have requested anonymity because the plans are not yet officially public. But Google will be offering what they call the APP for Gmail, the Advanced Protection Program. And the idea is that it is going to be a super secure service where that will be an optional feature for Gmail targeted at corporate executives, politicians, and others with heightened security concerns. And this is probably to keep people from leaving Gmail. You know, Google would like to not have people think, oh, well, you know, it's free, and so it's not very secure. If we really want secure email, we got to go somewhere else. Instead, Google is saying, no, we're going to require two separate physical security keys of some sort. Now, right now, as we know, they do offer a second factor technology, for example, using Yubico's technology and one of the variants of FIDO in as an option. They're going to, as part of this advanced protection program, require two different physical security keys, and no third-party apps will be able to gain access to your Gmail service. So your freedom and your flexibility of what you can do will be dramatically curtailed, but for people who really want security, that's a requirement. You'd have to silo mail and not allow apps to be able to get access to your account. And then they're going to really crank up the authentication level to create this level of security. Again, no idea when. It's not official yet. But and if it happens, apparently it's going to be called Advanced Protection Program. So again, in the wake of what we learned, Google is saying, okay, we're going to provide as much, you know, arguably more security than anybody else and a lot for a cloud-based service. And I don't know whether it'll be free or whether it will be...
I think it's for the Google Apps owners. It's for G Suite. I don't think it's for
okay.
us.
That does make sense.
I think it's
yes.
for the business folk. Yeah.
It does make sense. There was a bunch of mistaken news, but, you know, clickbait headlines talking about how DKIM had been broken. That's the domain key technology that we've been talking about recently. The idea being that a mail domain, like I'll use mine, grc.com, can publish through DNS its public key, and as it's sending email from its SMTP server, it signs the outgoing mail. That is, it adds a signature using its secret private key to every outbound mail. And then the receiving SMTP server is able to similarly use DNS to get the matching public key and then verify the signature on email claiming to be from GRC.com in order to verify it. This was designed as an anti-spoofing measure. That is, the idea being that no one could say that that email was from Apple.com or Microsoft.com or any major presumably trusted sender, the recipient would be able to verify. And as we said when we were talking about this a few weeks ago, there are some email clients or browser add-ons or email client add-ons that will independently check the DKIM signature. Normally, that's done at the SMTP server level, where incoming mail will be rejected if it doesn't, if the signature doesn't match. So, what has been claimed in the news recently is that it's been broken. Well, it has not been broken. The crypto is strong and was done right. What was broken is that email itself has always had a problem sort of with its own security. We have this notion of multi-part extensions and the concept of a mail envelope, that being the thing, sort of an abstraction of the email content and the headers forms an envelope. Well, that's what the sender's private key is signing. Well, it turns out that it is possible to spoof the signature, that is to spoof the contents of the envelope so that it's possible to add your own different message, keep the real message from being seen, yet still have the DKIM signature shown as valid, despite the fact that what the user is seeing is not the contents of the envelope that was securely signed, but something that a spoofer attached to the email. So the upshot is that the assurance that you believe you're getting from DKIM is bypassed, so that if your email reader is telling you that it's checking the email signature, it could show it being valid, but the contents of what it shows you is not what was signed in the envelope. So it's a spoof attack. And this is one of the things we're seeing is sort of like, you know, as we keep getting better and better with security, we keep closing loopholes and closing back doors and getting better. This whole problem of spoofing remains elusive because our clients are still, in this case, still not strong enough to be hardened against that, because they're trying to be flexible enough to give us the features that we want in email, which were extended over time to without thinking about security as closely as they should have been. So anyway, I got a bunch of tweets from people saying, oh my goodness, DKIM is broken. Well, no, but it is spoofable, unfortunately. And over time, I think we'll see that get hardened up. But for the moment, it is the case that someone could send you something that where what you see is not what was signed, and therefore it could say anything and cause you to be misled. For example, it could contain a malicious link where you trust the link because you're looking up at your DKIM monitor and it's saying green. It's saying, yes, this is trusted email. And so you go, oh, fine. And then you click the link and you could get compromised as a consequence. So, I mean, it's not good, but it is not the case that the DKIM system itself was broken. It was basically just bypassed. Someone ran a bypass. And finally, there was another Google researcher sort of got around to taking a look at a very popular small suite of services. It's known as DMS Mask, D-N-S-M-A-S-Q, DNS Mask. It's very popular in small networks, in small routers, anything where you have a small footprint server where you want to provide local DNS and DHCP services. So, for example, I mean, it's what we probably have in many of our home Wi-Fi routers or standalone routers. It's they're lightweight services to provide local DNS caching and lookup and dynamic host configuration protocol, DHCP, which is, you know, the obtain IP address automatically service. It's widely used for tethering smartphones and portable hotspots. Many virtual networking virtualization frameworks use DNS Mask as their virtual machine DNS and DHCP systems. It's supported under Linux, Android, the various BSDs, and Mac OS X. It's included in most Linux distributions, and there are ports for it in for FreeBSD, OpenBSD, and NetBSD. So, you know, it is widespread and popular. Ubuntu uses it, for example, by default for their services. So what was found was, I think it was 7 or 8 remote code execution vulnerabilities, but remote in the sense of remote from the device, not in the sense of internet facing. These are all local LAN side attacks. So less to be concerned about. It's not, doesn't mean that suddenly there's a new vulnerability for all of our routers that we need to worry about. These are, because these services are LAN facing for clients on a LAN, clients of a router on a LAN typically, it means that if you had a malicious device, maybe a malicious IoT device that had been updated with some malicious firmware, it could arrange to execute code on your router. Well, that's not good. That's certainly not good. But it's less bad than if anybody anywhere in the world were able to scan for this vulnerability, which is probably very widespread. So our takeaway, and this is just yesterday that this came to light. Our takeaway is that to be looking for firmware updates for our various devices. Hopefully, people will start pointing fingers at specific vendors. This is just because this is less than 24 hours old. We don't yet know model numbers and makes and firmware versions and so forth that are vulnerable. I think probably we'll be talking about this next week as more information comes to light. It'd be fun also to find something that can identify whether the routers that we're using are vulnerable, much as malicious clients could exploit them. We may be able to do that, but you know, they are remote code execution. So what I think we'll need to find is be looking for updates to firmware for the devices we use. And in this case, it would be a good thing to apply them, because you don't want a single malicious device to be able to take over your router and then potentially have access to both your internal network and open it to the outside world. And Leo, I heard you talking about the EFI firmware vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I wanted to get some clarification from you on that one.
Yes. So a tech firm has taken a look at the pervasive problem throughout the entire industry, not just the problem is not just Mac specific. It's Duo Labs. And these guys took a look at a whole bunch of Mac machines. It was it was 10s of thousands of Mac machines. I want to say 43,000.
Yeah, I think it was something like that.
Something like that, yeah. And they found an overwhelming number of specific Mac models were vulnerable, meaning that they were running EFI code today with known vulnerabilities. Now, okay, that's not immediately a problem because an EFI vulnerability, first of all, is very difficult to exploit. It's more, you know, someone gets physical access to your machine and tinkers with your system in order to get something installed in EFI. So it's difficult to exploit, though very powerful if exploited, but difficult for the average user to deal with because it's pre-boot. But what it means is that AV software can't really see malware there because it's underneath the OS. And what it enables, what EFI exploits, if they're exploited, enable, are virtually undetectable super rootkit style pre-boot attacks where, you know, where power being turned on before the system boots, EFI is running around setting things up, getting the hardware going, and has full access to the system. It's what then chooses which drive to boot, finds the bootable partition, loads it into memory, and gives it control. So if that's been made evil, that's really bad. So the problem is that, first of all, there's maybe a lack of focus and attention on this. It's also the case, as you mentioned during MacBreak Weekly, Leo, that attempts to upgrade firmware sometimes fail silently. And once it fails, it doesn't pass the required checks. There may not be room in available flash memory to install the firmware because a lot of other drivers have been added over time. I mean, there's just many different failure modes. And so it's sort of like, you know, I mean, I have the experience because I have a small iPad where it was complaining for a while that I couldn't update iOS because there wasn't enough room. Now iOS is, you know, Apple has solved that by allowing some apps to be removed temporarily to make space for an update, and then they're brought back in, which is kind of a clever workaround. We don't have that capability for EFI. So as a consequence, what these guys found, what Duo Labs found, was that there is a widespread lack of current firmware in Macs. But not only Macs. All they looked at was Macs, but I would argue that because the general PC market, whether it's running Windows or Linux, has a greater disconnection between the OS and the motherboard. For example, Microsoft doesn't care about EFI because they're providing Windows. Apple cares about EFI because they're selling the hardware and all the software that goes on top. So it's really up to your motherboard manufacturer to deal with EFI, and motherboard manufacturers don't really care that much. I mean, they may have updates, but then it's up to the user to go get them. So we're sort of in a mess with this, which is why it's good that the vulnerabilities, if they exist, are difficult to exploit and unfortunate that it's difficult for average users to deal with. The best takeaway I have is that for the Mac's EFI firmware, there is a free tool that you can use to check what's known about your EFI underneath your Mac. It's called Effigy, as a cute little play on EFI. It's EFIGY.io. Effigy, EFIGY.io. That's a shortcut that takes you to a GitHub page where these guys are using an effigy API in order to tell users about the state of their firmware. This is still under development, and it will. What we need now is a mature database to connect Mac makes and models to this firmware they should have in order to compare to the firmware they do have. This thing will show you what you do have. It provides a means for getting for gaining some insight into that. And I think over time, we'll be seeing this mature. Unfortunately, this is Mac specific. Well, unfortunate for PC users, non-Mac users. It's Mac specific. All you can really do is take the effort to check in with your motherboard manufacturer, and almost, I mean, if you haven't checked for a couple years, and really who does, because it's not automatic, check to see, you know, check your, normally your boot screen will show you what version of EFI you've got while your system is booting. Go to your motherboard manufacturer, see if there's new firmware. The old wisdom, I would argue, of, and this was the wisdom for motherboard firmware, if it's not broken, leave it alone. Well, unfortunately, all EFI firmware is probably broken. It's working, but it's vulnerable now. So we've moved from a world of, if it's not broke, don't fix it, to a, if it's old, it's probably broke, and you don't know it. So it's worth patching it with the latest version. I think the advice now needs to be specifically because, as we know, attacks never get weaker. They only get stronger. So it's worth knowing that your motherboard is running the most recent EFI firmware that your motherboard's manufacturer makes. And the good news is,
the interesting thing on the Mac, I don't think there's any way to manually force an EFI update. It's not like a PC motherboard where you can go to the manufacturer and download the firmware.
Yes, and that's the perfect segue, because I was just going to say that the good news is this has – Apple has responded to the press coverage, and they've said they're kind of dodging it at the moment because they don't have an answer immediately. But this has shined a bright light on this, and Apple can and probably will take responsibility. So arguably, Mac users have a little bit of a spotlight on them at the moment, but Apple can step up and, you know, give this better attention. And then you're glad you're a Mac user because Apple can take care of it for you. You'll just get some, an update, and you won't know why, but things will spin around on the screen for a while and then settle down, and you'll be safe again. So that's good.
Yeah. They put that in High Sierra too. So if you have High Sierra or you don't have High Sierra, it might be another reason to upgrade to the latest version of Mac OS, because there's an EFI checker. They check weekly now.
Just a real quick little mention of an IE bug. I'm not, IE is sort of, well, I guess those of us who are not yet on 10 are still using IE on everything before, unless we're not using, Chrome or Firefox or Opera or anything else. It came to light that there is a bug in Internet Explorer's handling of the URL bar. And it's kind of cool and subtle. And again, it's one of those things that everyone is going to jump on until it gets fixed. JavaScript running on any ad or page you're visiting can intercept when you hit the enter key after entering a new search term or URL as you're leaving that page. Whoops. So it means you're somewhere and you go, okay, well, you're done being there. So you type something new into the URL field, either as a URL to go to a website or as a search term. When you hit enter, before leaving where you are, script on that page can capture what you typed. and send it back to the site you were visiting or any of the ad suppliers, which is not behavior that you want. Only IE does this. It's a bug. It'll get fixed. I don't know how soon. Probably not by next Tuesday. That's going to be the second Tuesday of the month, since today is the first Tuesday of the month. So it seems like it's, it doesn't give Microsoft much time. Maybe they can do it in time. It would be nice. But again, it only affects IE users. But it's the kind of thing that might provide some information the bad guys would want. And if you're using IE, they can get it until Microsoft gets that patched. I had one little bit of miscellany. Leo, while you were away, two sci-fi shows premiered.
And I haven't seen either.
The Orville and
Discovery, yeah.
Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
I was negative about Discovery with Father Robert because I'd only seen the first 5 minutes of it. And it was so painful that I just said, okay, let's switch back to whatever.
It got a lot of bad reviews, though. It wasn't just you.
Yeah. I know. And I'm not surprised. I did sit down and watch the whole thing again. I gave it a try. And then I'm remembering how bad the first few episodes of The Next Generation were.
Oh, okay.
Even with Patrick Stewart and Frakes and the whole, the core crew, it was bad for the first maybe half a season. They were like shouting at each other across the bridge, and Picard was being really annoying. And they found their groove, and it was arguably one of the better franchises that we had. So I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. But and I also, my plan is to wait for the first season to be finished, and then do my CBS All Access and watch not only all of Discovery, if I end up hearing that's worthwhile, but also The Good Fight, which was the continuation of The Good Wife that was on CBS for so many seasons and so worthwhile. And Leo, I didn't make it past 10 minutes of The Orville.
Oh, really? The only one I really want to see, but you have to be a fan. If you don't like his humor, if Seth MacFarlane's humor.
And I recognize I'm very finicky about humor. Yeah, I like, Seinfeld.
I love Family Guy, so I think I would like Orville. But
give it a try, because it certainly is, sci-fi setting for that. It wasn't my kind of humor.
He's an acquired taste, to say the least.
I had a really fun story about Spinrite and Drobo from Stephen Perry, who is a CISSP or has his CISSP. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the subject, it was dated email incoming September 28th, so just last week, said Spinrite saves a Drobo. And there's an interesting lesson here. He said, "Hi, Steve. Have a Spinrite testimonial for you. You could title this one, Spinrite Saves a Drobo. I have a Drobo FS NAS device that is about 5 years old now. When I set up the Drobo, I made sure that each of the 5 2-terabyte WD, Western Digital, black drives passed Spinrite before they were installed in the Drobo. This past Sunday, the first drive bit the dust." Mm-mm. Okay, now remember, the Drobo is a RAID, so that's okay. You can lose a drive, and it'll say, "Whoops, we got a problem here, but we can still read all your data." So he says, "I swapped out my spare 2-terabyte drive," so he had another one standing by, as he should. He said that had also passed Spinrite. "And during the rebuild process, one of the other drives," "went offline. And Drobo was setting off alerts that too many drives had failed or been removed." That is, the drive just completely died. He says, "I was able to safely shut down the Drobo, remove the drive it thought was missing, run it through a level 2 pass from Spinrite," he says, "which took 11 hours to complete. The drive was then returned to the Drobo, powered on to find the Drobo was now seeing the drive and was able to successfully rebuild the new drive and all is good again. So essentially, as we know, a RAID 5 allows you to lose one drive. Or another way to look at it is any given sector on one drive can be sort of recreated by using the other drives to calculate the lost data in a single sector of one drive. Or you could lose all the sectors of one drive, and then the other drives can be used to calculate the lost drive's contents. That gives you the redundancy of RAID 5. But you cannot lose two. And that's why now we're seeing increased use of RAID 6, because in drives have gotten so huge that exactly what happened to Stephen Perry is beginning to be seen. And that is, the first drive dies, you swap in a good one, and during the rebuild process, where you temporarily have zero tolerance of any failure, another drive dies. And that's why, for example, at GRC, I'm running RAID 6. And it's expensive in terms of you don't get the data now of two drives. On the other hand, you get double redundancy. With RAID 6, I have a four drive RAID 6, and any two can fail, and I'm still okay. And remember that, and because we've talked about the Drobo before, although it's expensive, the Drobo does allow you to use extra redundancy. It'll take away a chunk of your storage, but you can say, no, I need extra safety. Most people don't do that. They figure, like as Steve did, hey, I've got RAID 5 and I've got SpinWrite. As it happens, thanks to having SpinWrite, he was able to recover from that window where there was zero tolerance. He could not afford to lose another drive, and he did. But SpinWrite got it back. The Drobo was able to rebuild. Now he's back up to full redundancy.
And he should turn on the two-drive backup.
And maybe that would be good.
I do that on all my Drobos and my Synology as well, if you have that as a switch.
And suspenders. Yeah. Belt and suspenders and SpinWrite.
I suppose three drives could fail, but, it gets diminishingly small. We had go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we had a funny thing happen because we had a drive that was a little flaky. We used a Western Digital Gold for rerun playback, and it was flaky. And they pulled it. They were going to get a new one. And then somebody, I think Russell, very sharp-eyed, noticed that the label on the gold spelled Thailand with a lowercase T. It said made in lowercase Thailand. And he thought, we'd gotten them on Amazon, but from a reseller on Amazon. And he thought, that's... So they opened it up, and it is a counterfeit Western Digital drive. We bought it on Amazon, but from a third party, not from Amazon directly. And you'd have to look really closely with a magnifying glass to see a product of Thailand. But, wow, I mean, really... So somebody's taken crap drives... and just slapping a sticker on them and selling them as enterprise grade 2 terabyte Western Digital drives.
Wow.
So be careful. I've said this, by the way, this is the sticker they put on it. So we wouldn't use it. It says fake news. you would just assume, well, I got it on Amazon, but really you got to be careful on Amazon because a lot of times you're not getting it from Amazon. You're getting it from a third party. And it means sometimes getting an Amazon doesn't mean anything more than getting it on eBay. And you wouldn't really buy a hard drives on eBay, would you?
Nope.
It's not that it's made in Thailand, CR1. It's that it's a lowercase T in Thailand. I had a watch for a long time, a Rolex. It said made in Geneva with a J. That was how I knew. But it was only $10 in New York. Let's take a little break. Steve, you can caffeinate, and I shall talk about our sponsor of the hour. Of course, IT Pro TV. These are a great bunch. Yeah, you're the IT Pro TV guy? Yeah. Nice. We have somebody in the studio audience join us who... You just took that SpinRite message from a guy with a CISSP. Where did he get that, I wonder? Well, maybe he got that cert at IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV was started by Tim and Don, a couple of IT trainers who said, you know, it would be kind of cool if we did like what Twit does, which where we had a network which was streaming IT information 24/7. They could watch it on their, you know, their Roku on their big screen TV or their Chromecast or their Fire TV or their Apple TV or their PC or their iOS or Android device. They could, you know, just kind of by osmosis learn everything they need to know. And then IT Pro TV was born. And now, of course, they have three studios. Right now they're doing, let's see, what am I watching? CCNA SecOps. Yikes. So this is the kind of material you want if you want to learn.
This exam especially. Okay?
He's talking about the exam, right?
About you reading through this document.
And by the way, they have study groups where you go through exam questions. If you have trouble with particular questions, you can go to a particular part of the channel. Now, you're saying, well, it's live. But no, but that what they're doing is they do 125 hours, new hours every week, but they've got thousands of hours in their library on every possible. You see, I'm taking the Certified Ethical Hacker course, but there are, and Wireshark, that's a good one, but there's every, you know, AWS Certified Solutions Architect, the Cisco certs that you might want if you want to be a CCENT or a CCNA. It's all here. Lots of security stuff. They've got the ISC squared certs, including System Security Certified Practitioner. Getting those certs is the first step to getting a job. But then once you got the job, you know you got to keep your chops up, right? I'd love this. Cybersecurity First Responder. Wow, it's a cert. DoD Directive 8570 compliant. How to be a security first responder. Did you know, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, last year, there were more than 1 million job openings in cybersecurity. If you're listening to this show, dude, dudette, this is for you. If you're listening to this show, there could be a great job awaiting you. And if you've already got that job and you really want to keep up or maybe expand your skills, check it out. itpro.tv/securitynow. They've got individual subscriptions, which are very reasonable, but they also have a fantastic team solution. The team solution gives you group pricing, a supervisor portal, so you can keep track of how your team's training. You can actually see their completion, course completion, their video viewing time, their downloads, the logins, so you can keep track of how it's going. They've got some great stuff. These guys Tim and Don, they started on Security Now years ago. They were just this little company. Now they're a monster. They're doing such great work. And if you want to get into IT, this works. itpro.tv/securitynow. Go there now and find out how you can get a subscription for yourself or your team and get some training, get some skills, expand your skills, and get in on that million job openings out there. Free 7-day trial if you sign up for an individual monthly membership using the offer code SN30. So that's a good deal, too. Plus, you get 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. That's itpro.tv/securitynow. And if you want to know more about the team solution, you can sign up there for a free demo of the supervisor portal. Did you just watch it? Did you take courses? Did it help you get a job? Or?
I got one cert.
He got a cert?
Yeah.
And it helped?
Yeah.
It's fun. It's more fun than getting the books and grinding it away, isn't it? And you took additional stuff, server stuff. Nice. And it helps him with his job. Isn't that nice? One of our listeners in studio today. See, an unsolicited test. Have I ever met you before, sir? No. An unsolicited testimonial. itpro.tv/securitynow. If you're listening to this show, this is it. You're ready. All right, Steve. I think it's time to get to the topic at hand.
Well, we've got a couple closing the loop bits from our listeners.
Yes, sir.
Mark Havas, he sent, regarding your printing two-factor authentication codes to have them on paper, would you keep the images in a password manager like 1Password? Thanks in advance. And okay, so it's interesting. I don't understand, and I'm not picking on Mark at all, because many people, I mean, he's just asking, but everyone seems so resistant to the idea of printing their QR code for their authenticator. And I don't understand it. You know, it may be that we're all hooked on electronics or automation or cloud or something. But, you know, so we just sort of keep seeming to circle around this. I get it that people want a shortcut. They want more ease of use. But offline means offline, not online. If it's offline, it cannot be hacked. If it's online, it can be. So I'm not saying it will be, but it can be. So if you've got all your two-factor authentication QR codes in anywhere online, then Russia has a connection. They may not be able to use it.
Wow.
They may not be able to decrypt it, but online means online. And so I have no problem if people will say, oh, well, you know, I want to store them in my password manager. Okay, I'm not storing them in my password manager. While you were talking, Leo, I looked at this question, you know, and I'm not facing them toward the camera, but here's my set of
Where do you stick those,
QR
Steve?
Codes.
It worries me that they were that available. Are they just in a pile on your desk?
Yes, and Russia cannot get them.
Yeah, but maybe you can't either if you if you put some more stuff on your desk.
No, I know exactly where they are. They are offline.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point.
And that's my point. And I'm a little worried about this because Squirrel has some of the same imperative. And it's like, no, write this down once, yeah. Print this once, because then it's offline. But it's like people don't get that anymore. It's like, oh, everything's supposed to be online. It's like, yes, Russia wants that. So, okay.
Then I use Authy, which means it's online. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I had a little scare this morning. I got a call from Hover. James, very nice guy from Hover, said, your account's been compromised and somebody has changed your email forwarding. I use Hover to forward my email address because they own they register the domain name.
Yep.
And somebody added another email address. They didn't take the old one out, thank goodness. I guess the idea was to be surreptitious, right?
So they were CCing themselves.
They were CCing all my email to them. And the idea was that they would then ask for password resets and they'd get them. And I might notice, gee, there's a lot of password resets, but there's always have been. I mean, people are always attacking me. But, you know, I have my email address and they can't get them. They found it. I guess they had monitoring. I know you were talking last week about monitoring, how important monitoring is. They must have been monitoring, and they discovered the hack. They reversed it and notified me immediately. Hover, God bless you.
Yep.
I went and looked, and there was one Twitter reset email an hour before he called. But I have two-factor turned on, so it didn't do them any good. They got my password. But they didn't.
Yep.
They couldn't get my account because I had two-factor turned on. And it just really underscored for me not only how important two-factor is, but to your point, how important it is that two-factor be really separate. So if you're compromised in some way, and I'll give you an example. They could have tried to get my Authy login, right?
Right.
And then, now, in this case, it's fine because Authy uses Trust No One encryption. Only I know the passphrase that unencrypts my Authy database. So even had they, I'd be safe. But that's an example. You know, these things cascade. They get your email, and then they can use your email to get something else. And if they were able to figure out, you know, what your passwords and your two-factor would be, then it'd be no point in having two-factor.
So, well, and yes, and as we've been saying, one of the most troublesome things is that email is the typical password recovery system.
Yeah.
That is, you know, and this, again, this is one of the trade-offs that Squirrel uses, is there's no one to complain to. There's no one to say, oh, I forgot my password. I lost my identity. I mean, we make it really hard to get yourself in trouble, but not impossible.
Yeah.
And there's if you want security, then you cannot trust a third party, or they could be subject to a subpoena. So it'll be interesting to see how this, you know, plays out. But I've not cut any corners. I've said, no, I'm going to offer the world a truly secure system. We'll see if that's too much for everyone to handle. And it's not like everyone has to. You know, people who are security conscious can choose to do that. And everybody else can, you know, continue using their email.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, you know, how many times is I forgot my password? What do? They email you a link. Well, if somebody had your email account.
That's exactly and right. That's right.
They then said they've lost their, you know, they forgot your password because they're bad people. Then you would get a password recovery link, which they would grab. They would click on it before you knew any of this was going on and take over your account. Yep.
I'm so glad I listened to this show and I have two-factor turned on everywhere.
Yeah,
I feel much more secure.
This is really a quickie. I just got a kick out of this. Jamie, whose handle on Twitter is Linklayer, he said, my CS prof anticipated fuzzing in 1976. We talked last week, extensively about fuzzing. And he said to test input handling with punch cards from the trash and swept up from the floor.
That's a good idea. Random data.
It may not be true, but it was, or maybe it was. Yes, exactly. Just grab punch cards from wherever you can and feed them into your program and make sure they don't crash it. Michael Johnson asked, he said, how about a segment on taking a laptop on a flight out of the USA, working and returning? What's the best way to do this with no border hassles? Well, okay. So there's two problems with taking your laptop somewhere. One is the privacy of having its contents somehow exposed. The second is possibly getting it infected and bringing an infection home. So privacy could be obtained using an add-on that we've talked about often, like VeraCrypt, which encrypts the whole hard drive. But the other thing you could do would be to make a copy of the hard drive, if the drive is removable from your laptop, you know, clone it, and then leave the original drive home, which is the entire state of your laptop before your trip. Then encrypt the one you're traveling with for its safety, and stick it in the laptop and use it. Now you have the benefit of encryption, so only under your control can anyone see into it. And if while it's decrypted, it were to get malware infected, then the idea is when you bring it home, you just take it out of the laptop and put it aside. And then, you also want to, if depending on what work you do, you know, put the work up in the cloud before you take the drive out, so that you've moved your transient work somewhere safe. Yank out the drive, which is encrypted, which may not be convenient for you normally, and might have unknown contents on it. Maybe some foreign government briefly got it at the border and installed some malware on it or something. So the point is, you can no longer trust it. Well, you don't have to. So you yank it out of your laptop. You put the laptop, you put the drive that stayed home in safety into your laptop. So now you've restored your laptop to exactly the way it was before you ever flew anywhere or before you traveled. Now grab the work you did back from the cloud and you're safe. Having essentially removed any possibility, removing the inconvenience of having the drive encrypted if you don't normally want it to be, and any possibility that you brought more back with you than you intended.
Of course, and if they put an EFI virus on, you're screwed no matter what.
So. Yes. Yes.
In other words, don't let anybody have your laptop.
You really, if you can avoid it, you don't want to lose control, physical control of your laptop. And I did want to just add, if removing your drive is not possible, then you could use a tool like Image for Windows to take a full drive snapshot to an external drive before your trip. When you get back and before you hook it to your network, do not hook it to your network. Restore the full drive snapshot back to your laptop in order to wipe out anything that may have happened while you're traveling. So that's really the best I think you can do. You get encryption for to keep anyone from who might be curious from poking into the drive. And you're also protected if while it's unlocked and decrypted as it has to be in order to use it from picking up anything malicious. Many people naturally know because of the all-time favorite podcast, the Portable Dog Killer episode, have been tweeting me and writing to me about the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. I guess it was in Havana,
yeah,
where all of the diplomats, you know, are suffering serious hearing loss. And of course, they're saying, wow, you know, does somebody there have the equivalent of the portable dog killer technology? And of course, well, no, it's certainly different. They remember that this was high frequency but audible to dogs and us, which is why Mr. Archibald heard it when I zapped him with it at the end of the day in the story. Those who don't know what we're talking about may want to look back into and find that episode. But anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge everybody's – I mean, I've gotten so much input from people saying, hey, Steve, looks like they had a version of the PDK. And it's like, well, you know, whatever they're doing is unfortunate and certainly very malicious to, you know, impair someone's hearing by, you know, who knows what they're doing. Scary. James Parsons tweeted, if Squirrel requires a password re-entry every session, it encourages weak passwords, especially on mobile. He says special cares are difficult on phones. Okay, again, I'll just say, because I already did cover this, the long password is only needed once to tell the system you're you, which we have to make it hack-proof. And then afterwards, you do a per-authentication short version. And the good news is everyone will be able to play with this very soon. And as for phones, in the case of Jeff Arthur, who is the author of the iOS client, you do need, again, to authenticate yourself once. But then that enables Touch ID, and no doubt he'll be supporting Face when it comes along. And so then you're able to just authenticate with your fingerprint, just as you would expect. So again, a set of trade-offs exactly like what Apple has designed is the same thing we're doing for the sake of security and to make it not cumbersome. I mentioned this the payment API a couple weeks ago, someone tweeted the question, does this mean all adopting online retailers can stop storing our credit cards? Breaches would be far less harmful. No, it doesn't mean that. All the payment API means, which will be coming to all of our browsers, is that rather than us having to redundantly fill out payment forms all across the internet, our browsers can be a secure repository of that information, can contain our billing address, the credit card number, the expiration date, and so forth. And the API allows a website to request through an established protocol that information. It'll pop up a standard dialogue, which we'll get used to. So the standardization at the user side is very useful. we'll verify the stuff we're allowing our browser to send and then just say yes. And that will go then to the remote site in a uniform format to essentially circumvent the whole form fill out thing. So all it is a unification and a sort of a standardization of our submission of repetitive similar information so that to make it secure and uniform to the user and to sort of and smoother to smooth the checkout process and the payment process for the website. So it's a good thing, but what the server does, what the remote web server does once it gets the information is still out of our control. For that, you need PayPal or some third-party payment processor if you want to keep the sites blinded to that information. But still, a very nice thing. Okay, so now let's talk about what Moxie Marlon Spike and his gang over at who are developing Signal have done. Okay, Matthew Green, our friend and cryptographer at Johns Hopkins, said of what I'm going to discuss, he said, private contact discovery for Signal. Make no mistake, what Moxie is doing here is going to revolutionize messaging. I've got a link for all the details, and which I'm not going to go into because it's like lots of like pseudocode where they're talking about showing sample code to implement these different things. But here's what's going on. As I said at the top of the show, we recognize that it's one thing to encrypt the communications and a different thing to encrypt the metadata, meaning that I could have encrypted email, which I send to somebody, but the fact that I'm sending it is not encryptable. The envelope that contains the mail has to have headers for the destination and typically the sender for, you know, in order for it to go from point A to point B. It has to be addressed. So, and this is true everywhere. We've talked about, for example, even how HTTPS, the standard encrypted protocol for the web, it encrypts the contents and encrypts some of the metadata, but not all. People still know what IP you're going to because your traffic is going there. And in some cases, the first packet identifies the website that you're asking for, which is how the server knows which certificate to match for your connection. So there's always still some metadata leakage. That wasn't good enough for Moxie and his gang. So they said, okay, we need to solve this problem of a new Signal user wanting to find out which people in their own contact list on their phone, for example, are Signal users. How do we do that in a way that leaks nothing, even to the server that is providing the intercommunication? Because remember, this is all end-to-end encryption, meaning that they've designed a system so that the server is blind to the contents. They also wanted to blind it to this aspect, this social graph metadata. So one thing they could do, for example, is to hash the phone numbers of everybody in your contacts list. And so what you would be doing is you would be submitting a list of hashes of all the phone numbers. Send them up to the central server, and it then looks through your hashes for the hashes of all the other subscribers of this system for any matches. And if the hashes match, then we know that the phone numbers match. And so that says that you have the phone number in your contacts list that matches another phone number of a subscriber. And so, yay, they're a Signal user and you could connect to them. The problem with this is that there isn't enough entropy. There's not enough randomness in a phone number to prevent it from being brute forced. We know that you cannot go backwards from a hash, from the hash back to the phone number, but you can put in all possible phone numbers and get all hashes that match those phone numbers. So, and that wouldn't be that hard. There's just not that many phone numbers, and hashing is very fast now, thanks to the cryptocurrency people that have like moved all this down to silicon. So it doesn't work to hash a low entropy item like a phone number and use that for security. It's just not enough security. So Moxie and company understood that. What they came up with was very clever. Intel has a set of features for everything from Skylake on, which is like three generations ago. Remember, Skylake was the laptop I purchased, my last Lenovo, and the Windows 7 machine that I built a couple of years ago when we heard that Microsoft was not going to be supporting the older processors moving forward. Was not supporting the newer processors on the older OSs. I want to still be using Windows 7 for a long time, but I thought, I got to get a Skylake processor now, which I did for both my next main machine and my laptop. So Skylake and there's a Haswell and something since they all had this what's called SGX, Software Guard Extensions. And this is very similar to what the ARM guys have built into, known as Trust Zone. It's an extension to the Intel architecture, which allows the creation of protected software containers. The total size is limited to 128 megabytes, so it's not gigs, but it's still large. And it creates a protected enclave in an Intel chip, much as Apple has done on their iOS devices, you know, where they have a software, they have a cryptographic enclave where they can store secrets. This is a means supported since Skylake for doing the same thing on any of our systems that we have. So it was designed to support DRM, which, you know, none of us are big fans of. But the idea was that the actual contents of this region of RAM would be encrypted so that it could not be inspected. If it was inspected from outside the enclave, it would just be gibberish. It would be encrypted. But from code running inside the enclave, inside of this software guard, it would be Intel instructions and data, which could be viewed. The other part of this is the technical term is attested to. It supports attestation so that someone connecting to this from outside, like in the case of DRM, a content provider, could be assured that no changes have been made to this software guard extension enclave so that the encrypted data going in is being decrypted and is only going to be played once, not, for example, exported as a torrent and then put on the internet. So all of this exists and is in place. But this is all client side. What Moxie and company figured out was that this could also be done on the server side to create a provably trusted, essentially what we're the term we've used is an HSM, a hardware security module. Create a virtual HSM in, you know, just using Intel chip features to create a container where this hashing could be performed in a secure fashion. That is, a bunch of phone numbers would be hashed, and then that blob would be encrypted to prevent the hashes from being reversed. This encrypted blob would then go in up to the server, up to the Signal centralized server, into the Software Guard Extensions enclave, where it will be decrypted back into a list of hashes. Now, they worked all this out. The problem is that even though you cannot decrypt, even though something outside cannot see in, it can detect memory access patterns. So they recognized that that would create a technically, as we know, was known as a side channel leak. So just by inferring from the pattern of memory fetches, there's enough information there to leak what's going on inside. So then, and this is where I get into the pseudocode that they show in their coverage of this, they carefully worked out a way to sort of design a meta hash matching system that deliberately decouples the work being done to match the hashes with the memory fetches which are used to do the work. And the set of trade-offs they came up with was one where there's a relatively large setup time, which is required in order to obfuscate where everything is in this scramble. That takes a while, but you can, once that's done, you can batch all of the various clients that want to compare their hashes against this master list, because it's the master list that needs to be obscured. That can be set up once, so it doesn't matter how long it takes. And what they ended up verifying was that they could essentially scale to over a billion users using this technology, essentially making the algorithm aware of the caching and cache lines, explicitly aware, so that it would defeat the ability of anyone outside to observe memory fetch patterns and timing, thus the need to be caching aware to make sure that the cache hit and misses aren't also leaking any information. And essentially what this means is that Signal users using a Signal server with this technology, and by the way, it's on GitHub. It exists. It's in beta at this point, but it is freely published. The idea would be that the Signal server would implement this in the server hardware using Intel Software Guard extensions, and the client would be able to verify the integrity of this container before encrypting the hashes of its contacts' phone numbers and sending them into the container for decryption and matching and then weeding out. What then happens is what's returned is a subset of the context of the user's contacts, which are the hash, a subset of hashes, which are then re-encrypted and returned to the client, where it's then able to compare the hashes of all the phone numbers in its contact list to the smaller subset that are Signal users and flag all the contacts in all of the users in the contacts list as Signal users where they are, and then they can connect with them with absolutely zero leakage that any of the user's social graph has been exposed. So bravo to Moxie. And, you know, this is what we want. I'm just thrilled to see this kind of attention being paid to security. Over the course of this podcast, we've gone from sort of training wheels security, where it's like, oh, look, it's encrypted, we're done, to, oh, no, it's encrypted and we're just getting started, because we've, you know, our understanding that encryption is just a small piece of the whole problem has really matured over the last decade plus. Very cool.
Once again, Moxie Marlin Spike to the rescue. Steve, I was so glad to be back. I missed this show, and I missed the chance to ask you all the questions about my security woes and share my issues with you. We do the show every we're not constrained by time quite as much as we used to, so that's kind of nice. But the theory is we'll do this Tuesdays at 1:30 Pacific. We were a little late. Now you know why we were late. I was busily going through all my accounts to make sure I hadn't been compromised. I didn't want a Matt Honan. Whew, I was afraid.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
I tell you, two-factor, baby. If you're not using it, use it. We do this show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to tune in live, by all means, also join us in the chat room. They're a great group. Mashed Potato says, nice to have the full mustache back, Steve. So, IRC.twit.tv for the chat room. You don't need to have an IRC client, but by God, if you're listening to this show, you damn well better. You also, I couldn't understand why you wouldn't. You also can get on-demand versions at Steve's site, grc.com. He has a nice audio version. Plus, it's the only place you can get a written transcript of everything Steve says. Does Elaine take out the us and the, you know, you don't say
I told her to do so, and she balked a little bit 12 years ago because she wanted it to be exactly. I said, this is not a medical.
It's not,
you know,
court. We're not talking court here.
Right.
She's a court
right.
reporter. I think that's probably where she gets that.
And I should mention that her husband is having some medical challenges.
Dear. Oh, no.
Yeah. Bennett.
Sorry, Elaine.
So the transcript, she warned me yesterday, may be not available till the weekend. So. I already notified the people in the Security Now news group at GRC. It'll probably affect her for the next week or two.
Oh,
so
I'm
it's kind of major. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're thinking about you. And
yep.
She does such a good job. 12 years she's been doing this. That's kind of amazing.
Yep.
She's been doing it almost as long as we have. Just go to grc.com to find that and all the other great free stuff Steve gives away. And of course, his bread and butter. And if you like Steve, support him by buying a copy of SpinRite. You'll be glad you did. grc.com. It's the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Now, we have audio and video. I know it never baffles me. You didn't understand why we're doing video. I don't understand why we spent all that money on video. But people do like video. And if you want to watch, if you want to see Steve wave and do his live long and prosper properly with a thumb out, he does it right. And he does it with the right hand. No, you're doing it with your left hand. Should I do it with my right or my left? Does it matter?
Know.
I can't do it with my
unfortunately,
left.
Unfortunately, yeah, my right hand is behind the.
Yeah, you can do it. You can do it with both hands, which shows one thing: a misspent youth. Yes. If you want the video, go to twit.tv/sn for Security Now. Or I think the best thing to do is subscribe. You can subscribe to audio or video versions in any podcast application, Overcast. Pocket Casts is, I think, number two after iTunes, Stitcher, Slacker, TuneIn. You can even listen, you know, if you have an Amazon Echo or a Google Home, you can just say, if we're on the Echo, you say, Echo, listen to Security Now on TuneIn, and you can hear the latest episode. Increasingly, I think that's how people are going to be listening to podcasts at home. It's just asking for it on their Echo. Or it works with Google Home. The syntax is slightly different. I can't remember what it is.
Nice.
Used to be you could watch it if you had an Echo with a screen, but YouTube's turned that feature off. But listening is fine. You can also listen to our live stream if you want to join us live by saying Echo, listen to Twit Live on TuneIn. Twit Live is the live stream. Does that take care of all of our business? I think it does. I think it's time for me, sadly, to say goodbye. And live well, long and prosper.
Until next week, my friend.
What do they say on the Orville?
Luckily, I don't know.
You have no idea, and you're glad.
I'm never going to know.
It's probably profane. Thanks. We'll see you next time on Security Now, Steve.
Thanks, buddy. Security.